Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. This is another one of those kind of big picture episodes with a guest, and my guest is Jared Dubin, talented writer, also the host of Locked On Knicks, though like when I went on his show, it's all about the Warriors, except for some jabs back and forth. And talked about a lot of different stuff, from his expectations for the start of the year to the potential of Durant's role in the offense changing substantially to what it was in Oklahoma City. Also, some Harrison Barnes talk and the biggest threats to the Warriors, which is a question I'm asking just about everybody in these sorts of conversations. Runs about 45 minutes. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me.
So, you host Locked On Knicks, and the Knicks are a very different circumstance than the Warriors. And I was just...
I'm not sure if you heard, but people are calling the Warriors and the Knicks the two super teams.
People or person?
Well, that was the best part about what Derrick Rose said. It wasn't that he said us and the Warriors are the two super teams. He said that people are saying that when he is the only person that said that.
Yeah, that's becoming a more popular trope, especially among people who live in New York.
Yeah, many, many people are using that phrase construction.
And so what are you thinking and what are you looking for watching this Warriors team, especially early on? Like, what, because I know you're a big basketball fan, and just like, what are you expecting to see in the early days of this team?
In the early days, I'm looking to see if they have the sort of, you know, feeling out period that other quote unquote super teams have had in the past. You know, it happened with the Heat, it happened with the Cavs, it happened for the entire season with that Lakers team where they had Steve Nash and Dwight and Kobe and Powell. I think it's a little different because they had so many of the guys together already, and it's only one new element within the, you know, the sort of high minute and high impact players. So that's in the short term what I'm looking for. In the long term, I'm looking to see them elevate basketball to like a higher plane of existence. Like that's what I watched the Olympics for. That's what I watched them for last year. Like it's why they were the most fascinating team to me last season, even while they were beating teams by 20, 30 points. And some people were like, this is so boring to me. I was like, I could watch this all day. Like I love to see basketball played at the highest possible level. And I want to see them not only try to do that, but succeed at doing that.
Yeah. It's a different thing. And I think some people get lost in the idea of they want competitive games at the end. And while there is a value to that, I'm not going to knock the enjoyment of a close game. I mean, I watch a ton of basketball. It is something that I like quite a bit. But seeing a team execute, especially when they can do things in a different way than everybody else in the league, is a lot of fun to see. And it allows you to kind of test out ideas that were previously only theoretical.
Right. And look, I love close games. Who doesn't like watching, you know, two teams like really tactically and strategically go at each other down the stretch to try to, you know, figure out a way to get a win. But I can also find enjoyment in just watching a team do things that the other team just can't deal with, on whether that's offensively or defensively. And I think that this team has a chance to do that sort of on both sides, you know, with the way that they can move the ball and shoot the ball. And because of the way that those skills are leveraged, how they can also I would expect be able to get into the paint almost at will also. And then defensively with the combination of size and quickness they have. I mean, you saw it the last few years just with Draymond. Now imagine having a Draymond who's like 4 inches taller. I mean, and you have them on the court at the same time. Plus, you know, a guy that's as good in isolation and switching as he is in Iguodala and Klay Thompson as well. I think on both sides they're going to be able to do things that teams really just have no answer for, and I'm very interested to see that if they can reach that plane of existence.
There's a dynamic in play here that hasn't really been as discussed because it is kind of abstract at this point, though it will become real very, very soon, is that under the last couple of years, both because of continuity and because guys like Andrew Bogut are really good defensively, the Warriors' best defensive lineups were generally those kind of bigger ones, you know, having Bogut, having Azili and Draymond and all that. One of the huge, huge differences this year is that by losing them and replacing them with Zaza and David West, who will probably be better defensively than they've shown in the first couple games, but this changes the dynamic because now the small lineup, the death lineup, whatever you want to call it, might be their best defensive five-man unit, and that fundamentally changes the way Steve Kerr might want to deploy it, because if your best defensive lineup is that, you can use it as more of a safety blanket, whereas in his case last year, it was more break glass in case of emergency.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting because with that lineup, first of all, I think I'm going to go with Death Star for it because it's sort of like an extension of the death lineup. It should be at least so much more powerful even than the last year's version that, you know, even though it's going to be clearly their best lineup, I could see Kerr not wanting to give it quite as much use during the regular season as he did last year, or especially as often as Luke Walton did last year, who used it even more than Kerr, because you don't want teams to figure something out against it. You know, it's so much more valuable because I feel like, you know, it's going to be good. It's more valuable to keep it as that break glass in case of emergency kind of thing, so that teams don't get as good a look at it as they would if you used it more often.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. And also the idea that the regular season doesn't matter as much this year. So there will be less cases where you need to break glass in case of emergency because you lose a regular season game, so be it. And also another huge part of this equation, and why I was so surprised there was some reporting out, I was at a practice that I didn't cover, that Kerr was thinking about using that lineup 10 to 12 minutes a game, in the regular season, which was a surprise, is that Draymond has admitted before that it puts a lot more strain on him physically. And that's not really a surprise because...
Although maybe it won't with KD there, you know, with another... Because it's possible they could use him to guard the center.
Yeah, and it's also possible just depending on how they run it. Like, offensively, I don't think it's going to be any more strain because there probably won't be a normal... Like, one of the bigs won't be posting up. Defensively, yeah, sometimes you'll have a Marc Gasol or a Jahlil Okafor or somebody banging on you, and that's not great. But offensively, I mean, I think it's just going to be five out, free-flowing, and just absolute insanity.
Well, that could save Draymond some of the strain as well. You know, when they ran that death lineup, almost every possession was a Steph Draymond pick and roll. Now you can have, you know, Steph KD or KD Draymond or, you know, Steph Iguodala, Steph Clay, KD Clay, like... There's so many more variations you could do when, you know, last year's version, it was largely, you really only had two guys that, you know, you trusted to handle the ball in terms of running the offense. Obviously, you trust Clay to handle the ball, you know, within the offense when he gets it on a kick out or a secondary pick and roll, whatever it is. But now you have another guy who can orchestrate the whole thing and can play the role that Draymond played last year. You know, he could do either one of those. So it takes strain off him, I think, on both ends.
It does, and Draymond sometimes being in the corner is going to be something we haven't really seen before because it's never been a part of the Warriors' offense, but at moments he's going to have the Harrison Barnes role, and he could be really good at that. I mean, not necessarily making the open shots, which Barnes did admirably for most of the season until the end of the finals,
right.
But he can, when one of the things that I like to focus on in terms of a player's development, and Aaron Gordon is a great example of this, is... If you are a guy who can be a credible shooter, not necessarily a great one, what do you do on a hard closeout? And so that's basically two dribbles and a good decision. And Draymond, that part of it isn't a problem because he's been doing that for a couple of years now. Like that part of it he can do well. He just has to have the shot reliable enough that he'll get the closeout to get the two dribbles and a good decision. And so that is a major difference from Barnes, who couldn't do that very well. And we'll see if he can do it in Dallas.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote something over the summer about how teams are going to try to play them when they have that lineup. And one of the things that didn't make it in there that one person mentioned to me was just never close out on Draymond or Iguodala, because any possession that ends with one of the two of them taking a shot is a win. What do you think about that strategy?
if they're not on, certainly, but Iguodala has games where he hits 3 of 3, 4 of 4, in that kind of way. But you can make a very credible argument that it is the best case scenario. I mean, that's what's crazy about that lineup.
Right.
It's more
I feel
true,
like you just
more true in transition. Like, in transition, if that's what they get, great. But in the half court, most of the time, that's better than that's a better stop for the defense than most of the things the Warriors are going to get.
Yeah, I do feel like there may be a team or two that just says, okay, we'll live with Iguodala making 3 of 3 wide open threes. Like, if that's going to happen, so be it, and we were never going to win this game anyway.
Yeah, that's also a thing, and one of the major parts so far. So the game against the Clippers was the most notable preseason game they have played to this point, and they've only played three, is because they were able to get open looks for lots of different guys. So in the first game, it was mostly Clay. There were two times in the Clippers game where Curry got open from the corner in a half-court set. And you're sitting there going, how did that happen? Because in previous right. years, you know, he is the focus of the attention and everything like that. And one of, you know, we'll have to see how teams handle having two players who spent their entire career being the focus of defense. And as great as Russ is, when Russ and Durant are on the floor together, Durant is the focus of the defense. Because Russ is going to kind of do what he's going to do, and so you help and you do things like that. But Durant is so much more versatile of an offensive player that you have to handle him differently.
Well, it's the way that the focus changes on and off the ball, I think, is the difference really between Steph and KD. You know, with the Thunder, KD was the focus when he had the ball, and he was the focus when he didn't have the ball, even while teams were obviously keyed in on Westbrook when he had the ball. They weren't keyed in on Westbrook when he didn't have the ball because he's not a great shooter, and that allowed them to sort of tilt coverage toward KD. You have to pay even more attention to Steph almost when he doesn't have the ball than when he does. I mean, if he's open when he doesn't have the ball, that's an even easier shot than when he's pulling up off the dribble when he has it. So that coverage, all of a sudden, there, you don't know where to tilt it. Because you have to tilt it towards KD if he has the ball, and you have to tilt it towards Steph. If you're tilting towards both of them, all of a sudden Clay is open, and you have to tilt coverage towards him when he doesn't have the ball. Like, so the difference, I think, comes when, not so much when KD doesn't have the ball, but when he does.
Yeah, and that was one of the questions I've asked a lot of people on the show, and I'm going to ask you now, is just a basic one, and it's how would you defend a Curry Durant pick and roll?
With Curry with the ball, not the other way, not a reverse pick and roll,
whichever way makes you happy, man.
I mean, if there was a way that you could guard the pick and roll that made KD actually roll and not pop, that's how I'd play it, because at least he's then inside the three-point line and you can send help at him. But if you're putting two on the ball and KD's popping out to the three-point line, you're giving a wide-open three. If you're not putting two on the ball, you're letting Steph step into a three. It's more to me about what I wouldn't do than what I would, because there really is just no way to actually guard it and do a good job of it. I think I would be aggressive with my help off of both Draymond and Iguodala or any non-Clay guy that's on the court and find a way to put two on the ball and two on KD. And just say to Clay's guy, you're sticking with Clay, and live with one of the other two guys taking a shot.
It's such a challenge because you think about the geometry of the floor and just how much space. And the other big difference with Durant and anybody else is that he's really tall. So if you double him, but there's a seam and there's a guy who basically is wide open, because even if you just devote three guys to the pick and roll, which is what I probably would do, depending on personnel, then Durant's going to probably be able to see that. And as long as the player makes sure that he's in a window where Durant can see it, you're probably going to get a wide open three or layup or something like that. And it's crazy because Durant's going to have to be using different parts of his game than he has before, but he has expressed kind of a willingness and excitement to do that.
Yeah, and look, that is perfect because I wanted to talk about that at some point. After KD signed, there was like a, I don't know if it was a majority opinion, maybe it was a vocal minority opinion, that was basically just like, I can't believe KD signed up to just be like a glorified Harrison Barnes. I think that is straight up nonsense. Like, you're going to see, maybe he won't have, you know, the pure numbers that he had before in terms of, you know, his scoring, but you're going to see parts of KD's skill set that I don't think were put to full use in Oklahoma City just because of the way they ran their stuff and the positions he was put in because of it. You know, now he's going to be, I feel like we're going to see so much more of him as the role man in pick and rolls. And all of a sudden he's making that Draymond play where, you know, he's the guy that's a decision maker near the top of the key. Is he going to shoot? Is he going to drive? Is he going to pass? You're going to see a lot more of that. You're going to see him be able to put, you know, much more effort and use much more of his abilities defensively because there are so many other guys on offense that could do not necessarily take pressure off, but ease burden. I feel like there's a difference there. It's not really taking pressure off because, you know, it's still pressure, but he won't have to do quite as much, quite as often. So defensively, he's going to be able to do more. I mean, to me, it unlocks all new areas of his skill set being able to play with these guys rather than turning him into a glorified spot up shooter.
It will be exciting to see how he does defensively in a role that is more similar to what Serge Ibaka did. And we saw a little bit of that in the conference finals when they went to the lineup I called the Megadeth lineup with Ibaka and Durant at the four and the five. But over the course of his career, he hasn't been able to do that very much. And it looks like the most logical fit with his defensive skill set.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I know he's listed at 6'9", but he's, you know, probably pretty close to 7 foot. He's got a massive wingspan. Like, he should be able to do things defense. Like, think about the way Draymond plays defense. I mean, KD is just as mobile, you know? Like, he's not, I wouldn't necessarily say he's as strong, may not necessarily have quite as natural defensive instincts as Draymond does, but he's up there, and you add that ridiculous size and length, like, he should be able to do a lot of the same things that Draymond does, you know, playing in that kind of system, and freed in terms of being able to put more consistent effort into it on that end.
Yeah. Oh God, it's going to be fascinating to see how all this works. And offensively, the idea of what they're going to be asking for from the other guys, and something that stood out in the Clippers game in particular, happened against Sacramento as well, is when they played a center, that center was getting open in the center of the court a lot. Like, you know, let's say a little bit below the free throw line, because there's just so much attention on everybody else. And I have never really seen players get open at that part of the floor before.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see a lot of stuff, I think, that we've never seen before with this team. I think that that's going to be a pretty consistent theme throughout the season.
As a non-local person, are you as invested in JaVale McGee getting the 15th roster spot as it seems like almost everybody else is?
I have been very vocally anti-JaVale McGee for a long time, so I'm invested in the opposite. Like, I don't want to hear...
That's right, I'd forgotten that you're like that.
I don't want to hear about his nonsense. I don't find him funny. I don't find anything about him interesting. I think that he's a bad basketball player for the most part that has never helped his team win when he's on the floor in any way whatsoever. So I'm invested in the opposite happening because I don't want to have to hear about him all season.
You're not ready for the JaVale redemption story. Somebody made the analogy, I don't remember who it was, I wish I could give him credit, about Chris Anderson and that Birdman, you know, when he came back from his suspension. And because the big question
was, there's a pretty big difference there in that Birdman, before being suspended for drugs, was a useful basketball player.
Right. That is a very important distinction to make.
Yeah. That's probably the only distinction that matters. Can I actually hijack the questioning here for a second and ask you a question?
Of course.
Okay. Why is there a certain segment of Warriors fandom that, like, hates Harrison Barnes with the passion of, I don't even know what the passion of, but, like, more than any reasonable person would hate any other person in the world? And don't say it's because of the finals, because it had been going on for like 2 years before that.
Don't worry, I wasn't going to say the finals. There are a couple things. One, he came in with a lot of expectations. So he was the highest of their picks in the 2012 draft. The later ones were Azili and Draymond. And he, you know, he got outpaced by those guys a little bit earlier on. But the Warriors didn't have anybody who could fill his role. He was more of a role player, even though he was drafted in the lottery, drafted before guys like Andre Drummond. And also, this will be a big test in Dallas. To many fans, and I think to a point I would include myself in this group, Barnes didn't improve by as much as you would hope. And that's part of why I'm so cautious about Andrew Wiggins, is that when you have somebody who's physically talented but needs to get a lot better, sometimes that doesn't happen. You know, sometimes they don't put the pieces together. Sometimes they don't do that. And with Barnes, you can talk, the most easy example is with dribbling. I mentioned before that, you know, the two dribbles and a good decision, that's something he never really got to. And it can be, when you think about that he, you know, he did get better defensively, he was stout, Kerr talked about how he was surprisingly strong, things like that. And if he had improved by even, let's say, a small degree of what Curry and Draymond did, and some would argue Festus when he actually got on the floor, which is a very different thing than not getting better, then the Warriors would have been even better. And so I think a lot of it stems from that. And also, just, you know, I mean, from a personality standpoint, the nickname that I had for him, which never caught on, was the chaperone. And the reason for that is because that's, and that isn't meant to be a criticism necessarily. That's just who he is. You know, he's the guy who's around making sure that everybody else is safe and having a good time and is okay, like, watching over everybody. And that is a nice attribute to have in a human being. But it was a strange fit for this team, which even the guys who were a little bit more boring were easygoing and kind of fun. Like, Clay doesn't talk about everything in the world. You know, he's kind of, you know, he stays in his lanes, but he's personable in that way. And with Barnes, you can never really tell whether, at first it seemed like you couldn't tell whether he was being political, like, you know, he was just trying to cultivate that image, or that's who he really was. And eventually it kind of seemed like that's who he was.
Here's my thing. What's wrong with a guy just being a good 3-and-D guy? Like, you have three other stars on the team. Why is it such a huge deal that people feel the need to constantly denigrate a guy who stands in the corner, hits open threes, plays defense against threes, and is a huge part of their small lineup by playing defense against fours? Like, and every once in a while throws down a pretty big dunk, and or every once in a while, you know, bricks a jumper that he should make. Like, what's wrong with that? It's just a pretty good player. And it's just, to me, it's like the vitriol towards him was just insane. Well, for a guy that's just like, it's like, all right, he's pretty good. And, you know, not everybody can be a star.
There's a second part of it, and it gets into some more dark places, but it is the idea that it's, unless things are going perfectly, there always has to be a scapegoat. There always has to be a reason, something that's holding them back, something that's doing that. And why it got worse in the finals is because the Warriors actually lost something. You know, before that.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, finals, he was horrible. And look, it's obviously, but I feel like this goes it went way beyond people being disappointed that he didn't turn into the player that he was billed as coming out of high school, which was like Chad Ford next Kobe Bryant kind of stuff,
but
which was
also,
always ridiculous.
I think it's also the idea that he was the worst player in the death lineup. And so that was always going to be, you know, like when you're the worst person in something great, there's always going to be a little bit there unless it's super exceeded expectations. So it might be some of that. I've honestly never been completely sure about all of it, just because I think it's just maybe that he just didn't fit in a lot of other ways, just overall. And
it's been fascinating to me for the last few years to see like a very vocal segment of, you know, Warriors fandom and, you know, Warriors writers that I follow on Twitter be very openly like vitriolic towards one of the players in the team who I've always thought, like, you know, is he a star? No. Is he worth a max contract? Probably not. But he's a pretty good player and a useful player that fit within what they wanted to do and willingly played the role that they asked him to. Just stood there and hit threes and played defense. Like, that seems like a perfectly acceptable player to me.
And until Steph Curry got hurt, they didn't need more from him. You know, it wasn't a circumstance where, you know, where, oh man, if we had X player, we're going to do that. The Warriors won 73 games last year. Like, this is not a circumstance, and they won the title the year before. Like, it was not a circumstance where that was the missing link. You know, the missing piece was Harrison Barnes figuring it out. It would have helped. It always helps. But it's not that big a deal, and I also don't fully understand that. But there is a part of it, you know, there's no fan base that's 100% happy at any time. And so I think it might be some of that. It's not like you can throw that anger at Curry or Clay or Draymond, except for when Draymond does, you know, kind of like what happened in game four of the finals. And he certainly got some vitriol for that. I mean, that's, and he deserves it. You know, that was an incredibly stupid move that very possibly cost the Warriors a title. So, but that was,
Something that I wanted to talk about too, because there were people after the finals that were like, oh, what, or even during the finals where people were talking about Draymond as being like a guy who wouldn't be good if he wasn't a guy that was like a dirty player, which to me is just sort of insane.
It is insane. Like,
you take away Draymond kicking people in the nuts, and all he is like one of the few best defensive players in the league, an elite level passer, or someone who makes great decisions. Like, oh, that's it? Like,
well, and a lot of the, if you want to call it dirtiness that he has, is ancillary to his game. Like the kickouts on shots, he's been doing that since his rookie year. He was doing that since he didn't get any minutes. That's just the way he does that. And I mean, when it's kind of instinct, I don't really consider it dirty. It's the whole Matthew Dellavedova argument all over again. It's maybe more reckless than dirty. But the part of it is that Draymond, he plays with a lot of emotion. And so it's kind of that idea of, you know, like if you're redlining an engine, then sometimes bad things are going to happen, even if it's not, like, even if it's not a part of it. But I think he can tone that down. However, it is weird how, I think it's because the series went seven, that some of the earlier parts of the finals got under-discussed. So Harrison Barnes was arguably the Warriors' best player in Game 3. They just lost that game badly, because when Harrison Barnes is your best player, you're probably not going to win a lot. So that was a problem. Then in Game 4, he was pretty good, and then they won that game. But then he was horrible in 5, 6, and 7. So that was so his decent performance, his great performance in 3, his solid performance in Game 4 was lost in the shuffle. And then, you know, the whole Draymond thing, I firmly believe that they would have been meaningful favorites. That doesn't mean they're going to win, but they would have been meaningful favorites, even with the Bogut injury and everything else, in Game 5 if Draymond had actually played.
Yeah, I mean, look, Draymond plays that game, series is over. Sorry, like, that's
also
just the way
also
it
you're
is.
Giving Cleveland, they have to beat the Warriors at full strength twice, as opposed to having to beat them at full strength, and we're counting that as full strength for what they were in the finals. And so that's a lot harder to do. And beating the Warriors without Bogut and Draymond was not the same thing.
Right, and that, look, saying that the series would be over in Game 5 if Draymond played doesn't take anything away from what Cleveland did. That's
not
just the way things were going. And if he was on the court, it's in all likelihood would have continued that way. But that didn't happen, and Cleveland won, and they deserved to win, because that three-game stretch that they played was ridiculous, and LeBron took basketball to a higher level. You know, like I said, with what I hope to see the Warriors do this year, I mean, that's what LeBron did in those games. I mean, it was just preposterous, unlike anything I've ever seen.
And one of the lessons from that, and we'll see if the Warriors embrace that because they're still significantly younger than LeBron, is he turned it down for basically the entire season and then kicked it in for about four games, and it worked. It, you know, we can argue about whether that would have worked if Draymond hadn't been suspended for that game and all that kind of stuff. But that is a good template for these younger guys as they age, is that if you only have your fastball for 5 to 10 games, why use those 5 to 10 games in the regular season?
Well, that, I mean, so they obviously went very hard after 73 last season. I can't imagine, and not because I think it tired them out, but just because it's not prudent. Like, they can't possibly be planning to go after something like that again this year. Like, I would imagine they're going to be super aggressive in terms of, like, limiting minutes, not beyond anything reasonable. Like, Steve Kerr was on Zach Lowe's podcast, and he was like, they would all kill me if I tried to play them less than 30 minutes a game. But, like, if they keep them in, like, the 32, 34 range rather than, like, the high 30s, that's really good. And I would imagine these guys will all sit like 10 games or so, just like, because why play them all 82?
Yeah, there will be, both of those things will happen. And also, it could help balance it out if Kerr is willing to actually trust his backups, that they can just go to some of those lineups more frequently. And one of the big differences with the Warriors over the last couple of years, partially due to health, you know, Looney missed most of last year due to hip issues and things like that. They're going to have to do a good job of, when they have the players, keeping 13 guys on their active roster, because not only do they have the five starters that you only want to play for relevant minutes, but a lot of their high-end reserves, most notably West, Livingston, and Iguodala, you don't want to play those guys unnecessary minutes either. So if you take out five and then you take out three and you have a 13-man active roster, that means you have five guys left. And so they will be asking a lot of those players, which also from a roster construction standpoint means that you're going to have to make sure that it's the right group. And that's one of the big problems with having Varejao and McAdoo both on this team is that are you going to be playing them at the four and the five? Then what happens with Looney and like all these other things? They're a little bit center heavy, which again could go back to your best friend JaVale McGee. But Kerr has a meaningfully different challenge with this team than arguably any coach in the recent NBA in terms of rest and time management.
Getting off of that subject though, but just because you mentioned him, is the hipster Warriors fandom more obsessed with Looney or Patrick McCaw?
Right now it's McCaw because McCaw's on the floor more and playing better, but it could shift back to Looney if he plays well. There's plenty of obsession about this team to sustain both of them, but right now McCaw's the leader.
Interesting. I feel like big point guards is like a natural obsession for people, and the Warriors didn't have really a bench guy to obsess over the last couple of years, so they just sort of glommed onto Looney because he was the only young guy that wasn't playing.
Well, it also happens with this team partially drafting 30 every year, or you know, being in the late first round, and some of these picks they sent to Utah and various other things, is that I'm not going to say they were devoid of good young guys because a lot of their best players were still pretty young, but those real project guys weren't really a part of it, especially after Nedovic got cut. And so that is something that a fan base just really enjoys, is the idea of a young guy who's like, oh, what could they be, and all that kind of stuff. The Knicks are another team that's actually suffered through that a little bit just because of the way that they've kind of built their teams. And it's something that a fan base just loves, you know, the idea of what could this guy be? And so you could argue this goes back to something we talked about before, that the closest thing the Warriors had to that was Harrison Barnes.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. The Knicks always keep their draft picks and stockpile them all the time. We've had a lot of, here in New York, we've had a lot of guys to project all of our hopes and dreams onto. So I think you're just wrong.
But yeah, that is a part of it. And we'll see with, you know, this might be another redshirt-y situation with Damian Jones. And it with the issue where it's not necessarily that he's going to sit out the whole year, but that he won't really play on the big squad. And so it'll probably be another season for him to be that guy. But, you know, that'll happen eventually. And that's also, while it completely makes sense that he made this decision, if Dedmon had been on the Warriors, that probably, you know, even though he's 27, it probably could have been him as well.
Yeah, I mean, and look, if I think there was a Damian James. I think that might have been why you called him that.
Yes.
If he's going to play with the D-League, that's an active roster spot that they don't have when they want to sit guys, and that goes into your 13-man problem there.
It does. And so McCaw, if he can play well, is going to have a spot on this team in all likelihood, even if Elliot Williams makes the squad, which we'll see. We'll see. It still is the expectation, even though he's still dealing with that knee scope. But they're going to have to just manage the end of this roster very aggressively, and we'll have to see how it works in terms of buyouts, because will they maintain flexibility long enough? And as much as people like me are callous and say things like, oh, you know, if the right guy comes to Roth, they should just cut Varejao. Granted, I also think they signed him or something like that. The realistic human cost of things like that, you know, players who have really built a little bit of equity, not only with the team as an organization, but with the coaching staff. You know, Steve Kerr really likes Anderson Varejao. So that sort of thing is unrealistic. Of course, if the right guy, you know, if this year's Joe Johnson says, I want to be a Warrior, then maybe you make that decision. But if it's a fringe upgrade, they're not going to do it.
Right. And I know that there are fans and writers and whoever that don't like that practice, because it's like, why would you take this guy who, you know, like, you know what you're getting out of him, but what you're getting isn't all that good. I think especially when, you know, you have such a good team, having comfort in what you're getting in case of emergency, that I can see the appeal in that. You don't want to throw a guy out there and have him not know what he's doing. And at the very least, you know, someone like Varejao won't be that. Is he going to be good or great? I mean, probably not. Although we did see like a few 6 or 7 minute stretches in the finals, or sorry, in the conference finals where he was really good. But I see the appeal of the comfort level with guys, especially in a team that is so top heavy like this one.
And that comfort goes on the court and off the court, because some people really like, you know, going for these big, big swings with guys at those late roster spots. Lance Stephenson is the most obvious example this year, because very talented guy. I've advocated for him in various systems, but there certainly are some things that concern you in terms of his place on teams and everything like that. And the Warriors can make a justifiable decision that it's not worth it for them, because you can make those sort of swings. J.R. Smith is one for, you know, that when a guy is that talented and could potentially be a starter, sure, you can have one of those guys on your team, no sweat. That's great to do. But when it's your 15th guy, the big question is, like, there has to be a lot of upside there, and that's where the McGee question goes. But you can be risk averse if you're as good as the Warriors are.
Right, they're not like in need of a talent infusion. You know, like they have plenty of that. They just need guys that can step on the court and do what's asked if they need to do that. You know, like they don't need to take upside swings because of the talent they have at the top of the roster.
Yeah, and they can save that for if the right person comes along that it isn't a swing. You know, like if that person is available at some point through getting cut. Like, one guy that I've suggested at various moments is Jose Calderon. Like, if the Lakers end up buying him out, that would be a nice little guy, depending on what happens with the health stuff, just because he can capably run an offense. You know, that's a little bit different. Or there are some swingmen, you never know who's going to hit the market, that could eventually do that. But that's a, you know, that's a different thing than a Lance Stephenson.
Right. And look, I think Calderon makes sense in that he could put even more shooting on the court for them somehow. But he's not necessarily a quick enough decision maker to fit in the kind of thing that they like to do. But I think it makes sense in terms of the not necessarily high ceiling, but high floor guy as well.
He'd be a great garbage time point guard for them. Like if they feel like later in the season that Ian Clark just isn't his game, because he's much better as a catch and shoot guy than a creator, then, you know, getting somebody. I had even toyed with the idea of Luke Ridnour before. And what that gets to is the idea that Sean Livingston shouldn't play unnecessary minutes. And so having somebody who can run the offense enough that your garbage guys or your third unit, whatever you want to call it, won't get run off the floor. Because that was a big part of the story of Steve Kerr with this team, is that at various moments, most notably a Phoenix game that I think was 2 or 3 weeks into his tenure with the Warriors, where the backups blew like a 15-point lead. And, you know, the Warriors ended up getting the first seed and all that kind of stuff. But he was very reluctant to just give them the reins full bore. And there was a game last year where they almost blew like a 10-point lead, and I think it was like 45 seconds. And so you want to have enough there so that Kerr isn't going to be having an itchy trigger finger and think, oh my God, I have to get the starters back in.
Right, and a lot of coaches are reluctant to do that. You know, it's not like Kerr's the only one. Basically, the only coach that's willing to do it consistently is Pop.
And he has the best bench in the league, too, so it helps.
Right, and he'll leave them out there, whether they blow a lead, whether they extend a lead, whether they come back, whatever. Once he makes that decision where he's like, I'm going to the bench guys now, he sticks with it. And he lets them blow the lead, or he lets them make a comeback, or he lets their comeback fall short. And there are merits to that, and there are drawbacks to that. But it also depends, like you said, on the composition of your bench. Like, it's one thing when you have the Spurs bench and it's the best bench in the league, and it's another thing when you're throwing out, you know, Ian Clark and Anderson Varejao.
So one question I'm asking almost everybody, you know, the guests that I have on during this time before the season starts is, from what you know right now, what teams do you think are the biggest threats to the Warriors? I think of it in terms of 7-game series, but if you want to think of it single game, I'm not going to stop you.
That's interesting, because I think the list might be different. Single game, for example, I'm not necessarily sure I'd be worried about Cleveland. I think that their not advantage, but their potential to spring an upset would come out more over the course of a series as they used big bodies to sort of get physical with them. And in a one game in the middle of the regular season, you just the effect isn't big enough for it to matter. That's the same with like a team like Utah, who I think could use, do that big bodies type of be physical with them kind of thing also. But in a single game sense, I'm looking more for teams that can go small while still winning the rebounding battle by a lot. And I guess I'd throw like, I'm trying to think of who could do that. Yeah, I can't really think of one off the top of my head because you know why? Because they're really good.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to beat them.
They haven't done it yet, but Utah with Hayward at the four could do it because they could play Favors at the five. That'd be small.
Yeah, Utah, maybe Minnesota in just like a one game kind of thing. If they go like Rubio, Dunn, Levine, Wiggins, Towns, and Towns just, you know, kills them on the boards. But even that is like I'm stretching pretty far already.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the Spurs also.
Yeah.
Just because they could figure stuff out. Although I'm really worried about the Spurs defensively this year. I'm writing about that soon.
It's going to be a big challenge for Kawhi because now Kawhi and Danny Green are their two best defenders. And they haven't always had a good guy back there, a backstop, but they have a fair amount of the time. And that's going to be different. You know, it's going to be a major adjustment. And this is, it's crazy that he's already won it 2 years in a row, but if the Spurs defense is good this year, Kawhi has to win Defensive Player of the Year again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried in so far as I think they're going to be like a bottom half of the league team, but I think that they could be outside the top 10 potentially just because if you're giving Pau Gasol and possibly David Lee big minutes, you're probably not going to be all that good defensively. Like they have enough elsewhere, like Kawhi and Danny Green might be the best perimeter defense duo in the league, and then LaMarcus, he moves his feet so well and guards in space. But I'm worried about them at the other positions. You know, at point guard and center, there are not great defenders there.
And they're easy to exploit because all you really have to do is put Tony Parker's guy and Pau Gasol's guy into a high pick and roll. And
right.
You're just sitting there, and as great as Kawhi is, he can be a good help defender, but his best thing is shutting a guy down. And LaMarcus is better in space than as a helper. So if they can do that and get a seam, I could imagine Portland giving them some real problems just running Dame, Plumlee pick and rolls or wherever they're going to put Powell, because that's just a lot of trouble. And most teams are comfortable enough now running pick and roll with both of their big men that they can just send out whoever Powell's on, as opposed to them trying to be so tricky and saying, oh, well, we're just going to put LaMarcus on your best screener. And the Warriors are another good example of that. You know, like they can set screener roles with basically every guy on their roster. So those kinds of things, you can get the matchup you want as long as you have the right personnel, and teams will be able to do that. It's part of the reason why I'm feeling like we could end this season with Tony Parker not closing games for San Antonio.
Right. And look, I can't remember who said it, but I saw somebody on Twitter say the other day that Pau is a stationary rim deterrent. And I thought that was perfect.
Yeah, like that's a good point. Nate said something similar to that, but I'm not sure he said it on Twitter.
Yeah, maybe somebody was, you know, summarizing what Nate said. But that's, you know, where his strength defensively lies. But you get him in space, and all of a sudden it's a complete liability.
Yeah, and the Spurs are going to have to also let one of the big takeaways from the semifinals last year was that they weren't really willing to go outside of their norms to try to beat Oklahoma City. They weren't making Enes Kanter defend in space. And Kanter is, you know, he's good at certain things and he's bad at certain things. And they were like posting up Enes Kanter. That's what he's best at. Don't do that. Do everything else. And they're going to have to use every trick in the book offensively and defensively. And teams are getting so much more aware at maximizing those sorts of things than they used to be. Instead of just like, we're going to play our game no matter what, it's we need to take advantage of your weakness if we can.
Right. And I mean, that comes out more in the playoffs, obviously, than the regular season. You can't necessarily create all new game plans every single night. But the fact that they didn't really adjust all that much to OKC was like, look, Pop got out-coached, I guess, like you could say. It's a rare thing, but it does happen. It's like just because he's
in the playoffs,
right? Just because he's Pop doesn't mean he can't possibly be out coached. It's like you run into this with Phil Jackson also, where people are like criticizing his decisions, and then someone comes back and it's like, yeah, well, he's won 11 rings. What do you know? And it's like, yeah, he's won 11 rings, and he, you know, has more basketball knowledge than almost any of us will ever have, but that doesn't mean he's always right. Like, he could still be wrong sometimes. You know, it's the same kind of thing. Like, Pop could get outcoached. The Warriors might get outshot in a game this season. You know, like, things happen. Just because people are good at something doesn't mean they're infallible at it.
And there are so many aspects of coaching, and Pop is a master at a lot of them, you know, player development, team building, all of that sort of thing. And one of his weaknesses for a long time has been in-game adjustments or in-series adjustments. And most of the time it hasn't mattered because they've had great talent and because their base system was so good that they didn't need to. But we're getting into a different time in the league where, you know, you have to be able to adjust because there are so many different skill sets out there, and teams can take advantage of things that they weren't able to in prior iterations of the league. And so, you know, Duncan probably would have had more trouble this year because, like, let's say they're playing the Warriors, you know, they could play him off the floor. They did that a little bit in the regular season. And so Pop has that challenge, and you know, their different coaches have different strengths and different weaknesses. And another guy who's like that at moments is Doc Rivers. You know, Doc Rivers is a great coach. He's an amazing motivator of men, you know, gets guys to buy in and everything like that. But he still hasn't done the stagger with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. And we'll see if he has that happen this year. And so those kinds of things, you know, nobody's perfect. I mean, Kerr went back to Varejao after he'd been an absolute disaster in Game 7. And, you know, he refused to go to the death lineup in Game 7. That might have cost them the series, too. So no one's perfect, but that's part of what makes this so much fun.
Yeah, look, that series might have swung in that one stretch that, or it's not the series, the game swung in that one stretch that they brought Varejao back in. You know, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's the way it goes. Anything
they
else?
They wound up with KD, so.
Yeah, it worked. It all worked out. So you have this platform to talk to Warriors fans. Is there anything, any other ideas you want to discuss? Anything else you want to maybe have them look for over this year from your perspective?
That's a good question. I want to see what Zaza looks like in a situation where he's like asked to move the ball. Like, he's never really been anything other than, and look, that's very low down on the list of things that I want to see, but I feel like we've talked about a lot of other stuff. But for most of his career, he's just been like, okay, you get it to him, and he either puts it up or he gives it up. And their system is a little bit more free-flowing than that. Like, is he going to be able to make Bogut-type passes? I don't think so. It's going to be interesting to see the machinations of the offense, what happens if and when he gets the ball. The other thing was I'm very interested to see how people guard KD's post-ups.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to happen. Like, it's not going to be all spread all the time, like, especially if he gets a smaller guy on him and they want to go to a mismatch. Like, do you send help at that and turn him into a passer? Do you say, like, okay, we'll live with a post-up? I mean, you can't really do that with Durant. He's been the most efficient post-scorer in the league for, like, 2 or 3 years. So I definitely want to see how aggressive teams are in terms of sending help, because you want to get the ball out of his hands. But if you're helping with pretty much anybody's guy, because if it's Steph's guy or Klay's guy, the shot's going up. If it's Iguodala's guy, like, maybe he cuts to the basket. If it's Draymond's guy, then either the shot's going up or you're closing out and he's making, like you said, that two dribble and then a pass kind of play. So I definitely want to see how they play that and then how he reacts to it. He hasn't necessarily been a guy that's done a lot of, like, draw the defense and kick from the post, which I think is going to have to be something that he shows more often this year.
Yeah, and he's going to have more windows this year because also he's going to have so many good catch and shoot guys. So we'll see how that all works out. But that a lot of good points there, a lot of good things to look at. And thank you so much for coming on.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Jared Dubin for taking the time to come on. You can listen to Locked On Knicks. You can read him wherever his writing comes out. And the best way to find out is following him on Twitter, which is JADubin5. That's JADUBIN and then the number 5. He's a very talented guy. Love talking to him about the Warriors and pretty much everybody else. So it was great to have him on. And I enjoy talking with the Warriors with people who aren't really around this market also, because the way they see the team is a little bit different and the frequency with which they see them can sometimes be different. And that helps. Different perspectives are an important part of this conversation. So really did enjoy it. For those of you who haven't heard it, I talked with Ian Levy of FanSided yesterday, another smart, talented person, also used to be involved with Hard Paroxysm. Well, he still is. And so there's a connection between the two of them. But we'll be having a few more of those over the next couple weeks. And then once the season starts, the big picture stuff will take a backseat to actual basketball, which is exciting. And I'm already lining up guests for the recap episodes, we'll call it that, particularly for the preseason, but then I'll start lining them up for the regular season once we get a little bit closer. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, and different, you can reach out to me on Twitter at Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux, or you can, a longer thing, or if it's something you want us to talk about on the show, you can go to DannyLaRueMBA@gmail.com. That way I can keep it around more persistently, because with Twitter, it's really hard to keep track of stuff. You can also follow me on Facebook at Danny LaRue, or Danny LaRue, I don't know if it's at. And then you can keep in touch with the show, Locked On Dubs on Twitter, Locked On Warriors on Facebook, LockedOnWarriors@gmail.com. And I haven't mentioned this before due to my own kind of silliness, but you can also use LockedOnWarriors@gmail.com for any local, if you're a local business or anything like that and you're looking to advertise. One of the big differences between this podcast and a lot of the other ones I do is that it is more localized. It is more specific. So if that is something that interests you as a, you know, as a business owner or however, you can reach out to me there. It's probably the best way to do it. You can use any of the other forms of communication too, but that's probably the best one just to, so I know where you're coming from. And that is always welcome. And we can have a conversation and hopefully find something that works. And that is how some of my business relationships with other things in podcasting have come from. So probably lockedonwarriors@gmail.com is best, but whatever you want to use. If you support the show in other ways, the best way to do it is to subscribe, download every episode, and then leave a rating and a review in the podcast player of your choice, because that really does help. And then spreading the word however you want to, whether that be telling your friends, telling people on Reddit, whatever you want to do, Twitter, anything. Because the more that we can spread the word, the better it is. And I'm trying to build to having this, you know, really go large when the season starts, because that is my bread and butter, is talking about games and everything like that. So appreciate everybody. We actually got into the top 100 on the iTunes sports ratings last week. I haven't looked since then, so I don't know if it's gone up or down, but very exciting all the same. And I appreciate all the input as well. I'm building a backlog of questions and things like that, and probably do some sort of Reddit mailbag, not this week, but maybe next week. So trying to keep that as a regular feature of this, especially as the Warriors are playing fewer games and all of that. So appreciate everybody listening. Take care and make it a great day.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.